KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. On Saturday, the Seattle Sounders unveiled a new secret weapon. The team acquired U.S. national team captain Clint Dempsey. He took the pitch in a green and blue jersey, and apparently the fans went wild. Who is Clint Dempsey, and why is it such a big deal for Seattle soccer? Stephen Clare is president of North American Soccer Reporters and editor of Post America Soccer. Thanks for joining us, Stephen.
You're very welcome.
So for people who don't follow soccer, tell us, who is Clint Dempsey?
Well, the first answer is, if you don't follow soccer, why not? let's move beyond that. Clint Dempsey is probably as close to a legend in American soccer, or as close to Landon Donovan in legend status. He's the second highest goal scorer for the American national team with 35. He's played 99 times for the USA. He's lit up the English Premier League, which is one of the best leagues in the world. 2 years ago, he was actually voted fourth in by the Football Writers Association of England. That's their equivalent of North American Soccer Reporters. And he was behind luminaries such as Robin Van Persie, Wayne Rooney, and Paul Scholes. So he really is a really big player on the international scene. And now he's here in Seattle.
You mentioned that he's been playing with the English Premier League in Tottenham. Why leave there to come to Seattle?
Well, that's a very good question, one which we don't know the answer yet. I'm going to take a guess. You can sum it up as M&M, money and minutes.
Ah.
Tottenham Hotspur have just signed Roberto Soldado from Valencia, and it's become increasingly clear that Clint has gone down the pecking order in the Tottenham Hotspur squad. But he desperately wants to play because the World Cup is coming up and Clint Dempsey is a US player and he's not going to keep fit and keep in match practice by sitting on the bench. So minutes would be the first answer. And then, of course, money. If Tottenham were looking to offload him or take him off the payroll, Clint wanted to go somewhere where he could get good wages. Now, we don't know yet how much he's going to get. There are rumors of $8 million over 4 years per year or $4 million per year over 4 years and a cut of a transfer fee. We will know that when the players' union releases the salaries. But it's fair to say he's actually going to be making more money than the entire payrolls of many of the other Major League Soccer teams.
How did the Seattle Sounders get him? I thought there was a pecking order in Major League Soccer and that Portland was at the top of the list for the next big player to come through.
Your research is actually very correct. And this has been the subject of a lot of tit-for-tat and discussion, shall we say, between Portland and Seattle fans. From what I can make out, there is a thing, as you said, called the allocation rule, that if a player's rights are not with an existing Major League Soccer club, there's a pecking order. Portland were at the top, and theoretically, they should have had first choice. Now, there's a couple of caveats to that. First of all, Portland already have three designated players. So they could not have brought Clint Dempsey in as a designated player anyway. But the bigger controversy appears to be they don't appear to have got anything in return for shedding the status to Seattle who are behind them. Subsequently, Major League Soccer came out to, and I'm putting this in quotes, resolve the confusion, saying that the allocation rule did not apply to designated players. Now, that one surprised me a little because what it in fact means, if you extrapolate it, is that you can get around the allocation player rule, you can get around the order by just paying somebody designated player money, which appears to contradict the whole point of the allocation rule. On the other hand, however, Major League Soccer wants these players in. Now, if Portland Timbers had decided to play hardball, and they did do that with Vancouver's Nigel Rhiokoker, they could have, in effect, scuppered this transfer by just asking for something unreasonable. So I think Major League Soccer has probably got it right in saying that the allocation rule should not apply to designated players. What they got wrong is that not having this rule very clearly stated beforehand, in having to explain the rule subsequent to the Dempsey transfer, it does come across that they're bending rules or tweaking rules to favor this transfer, and some Portland fans will say favor the Sounders, though I don't especially think that holds water. I think Major League Soccer wants players of this caliber in the league at any club, and would have done what it would take to get him in.
So what does it say about the state of America's Major League Soccer that it has managed to lure Clint Dempsey?
As far as it says anything, it says a lot. I think it says more about the Seattle Sounders than Major League Soccer. Major League Soccer already lured David Beckham, who was the biggest soccer star on the planet, and arguably still is. It's already lured Thierry Henry, who's played in the World Cup for France. What it says about Major League Soccer is that they're willing to bring U.S. men's national team players home. So it says a lot about the fact that having American heroes in the American League is important. But I actually think it says more about the Seattle Sounders ownership. And I even wrote about this less than a week ago, that it was time for the owners to put their monies where their mouths are. They're always telling us what a great and big club this is, but they've not really spent the money that they're getting from the large crowds. They've now put that criticism completely to rest, and I believe it's a sign that will alter the trajectory of the history of the Seattle Sounders franchise.
Do you know when Clint Dempsey will actually start playing?
He's available. Their next game is in, ironically, he may not get a hero's welcome when he first takes the field because he's in Toronto, which he's not going to be welcomed as an All-American hero there.
No. No.
So that's irony. No, the irony continues. His next game is apparently in Houston, right next to his hometown of Nacogdoches, where he's very Texan, as Clint Dempsey. He may get a decent welcome there. However, I think the one that many Sounders fans will have penciled in is his home debut, which is against, go on, you guess.
Portland.
Yes. I am already licking my lips. He's going to get a rapturous reception. That's one of the games that the club has opened the top tier of CenturyLink Field to. I think they're going to sell another 10,000 tickets on the basis of the signing, and you know, enough jerseys to probably pay a day of his wages. And of course, you'd have 800 Portland fans there with an alternative point of view. It's going to be a sumptuous occasion in the Pacific Northwest.
Now, Stephen, I'm curious because you mentioned it's money and minutes that really are going to lure Clint Dempsey. He gets to work out. His aspiration, I'm assuming, is to play for Team USA in the 2014 World Cup. Will there be times where those aspirations conflict with his new employer's requirements of him?
It's possible, but not impossible. Jurgen Klinsmann is the American head coach, and he has said he would rather have his players playing in the top European leagues against the best competition. On the other side, he'd rather have them playing, and it was clear that Dempsey wasn't going to get that many minutes at Spurs. So he would probably have wanted Dempsey to stay in the Premier League. But the other point is that the Americans are as close as qualified for the World Cup. With all the teams, the top of their 16 group, three of those teams qualify, the teams will all play each other. So there might be some conflict, but by the time you know some of these qualification matches come around, that qualification could be in the bag. My guess would be that Jurgen Klinsmann would want to maintain good relationships with many of the Major League Soccer clubs and perhaps not take some of the players. So for this year, I would say no conflict, but it's a four-year contract that Clint Dempsey has, and in the end, I think it's the aspiration of at least Jurgen Klinsmann, some of many American players in the European leagues. However, it's the aspiration of Major League Soccer to have them playing here.
And just a last question for Sounders fans. Is the acquisition of Clint Dempsey enough to get them into playoff contention?
Oh, almost certainly. In fact, they were never out of it. I know there's been a lot of, I use the word whining and complaining, but I think some Sounders fans have seen things as much worse this season than they really are. If you look at the league table, it looks bad because they haven't played as many games as many of their rivals. However, if you look at the key number, which is points per game, you will see that the Sounders already sit fourth in the Western Conference and in the top five qualify. This is only going to get better. And besides, of the remaining matches, nine of them, I believe, are against the teams directly above them. So I already thought that Sounders are a pretty good bet to make the playoffs. Now I think they're an even better bet than that.
Well, I'm sure everybody's waving their scarves now. Stephen Clare, president of North American Soccer Reporters and editor of Prost America Soccer, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
16 minutes past 9 o'clock. Understanding U.S.-Russia relations in a minute.
Did you know you can name KUOW as a beneficiary in your insurance policy or individual retirement account, and you might be eligible for additional financial benefits? The next time you review your long-term financial plans, consider including KUOW. For more information, go to kuow.org/future.
71 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 85 this afternoon with lots of sun. If you're thinking about buying a house, is now the time or should you keep renting? Speaking of which, why are rents going up and is there any end in sight? If you're a homeowner, should you try to refinance? You have housing questions and we'll have some folks here to answer those questions at 9:30.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Even before Russia decided to give accused NSA leaker Edward Snowden temporary asylum, relations between the U.S. and Russia were strained, to say the least. President Obama says he's giving serious thought to canceling an upcoming summit between himself and President Putin. What does that mean? Dr. Stephen Cohen is professor emeritus of Russian studies at New York University. He joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
The Cold War ended decades ago. How would you characterize the relationship between the U.S. and Russia since that time?
Well, I never like to argue with a host, but I've written a couple things arguing that we can't be sure the Cold War actually ended with the Soviet Union. Look at the context. It's 22 years since the Soviet Union ended, and we have yet to establish a cooperative relationship with post-communist Russia. In every decade since the end of the Soviet Union, with the possible exception of a few years under President Clinton and President Yeltsin of Russia in the 1990s, there's been more conflict than cooperation. And what we've seen in the last, at least since 2008, has been a growing number of issues that generate conflict. And then Snowden flew into this, making things even worse.
Is it mostly foreign policy-based that sparks this tension, or is it something beyond that?
That's a really good question, and historians, I think, will write about this for years to come. There is a school of thought that says that the legacy of what everybody agrees was a 40-year Cold War, at least, from World War II, until Reagan and Gorbachev announced at the end of the 1980s that they had ended the Cold War, and they thought they had, that legacy weighs on us heavily today. It weighs on Russian and American elites, on institutions, maybe on public opinion, but I think much less on public opinion than on the elites. There's also the view that there's something about Russia that either provokes conflict with the United States or makes American policymakers more edgy than does, let's say, communist China. Because certainly if we take the issue of democracy and human rights, the situation is much worse in China, and yet we court China. We put aside the conflicts. On the other hand, I take the view, more empirical view, that if you look at the last 22 years, there have been great opportunities to establish a real partnership in world affairs with post-communist Russia. In the 1990s, after 9/11, when President Putin called President Bush and said, "George, we're with you, anything we can do to help," and other moments, even with Obama's so-called reset 2 or 3 years ago, and that each of these opportunities was lost. Hmm. And then you have to ask, and here's where I become unpopular, why was it lost? And the prevailing view in the United States, certainly in the political establishment, certainly in the mainstream media, is that Russia and particularly Putin are to blame, and that we have not done anything fundamentally wrong in our policy making toward Russia. I disagree with that, but that's a separate conversation.
Oh, well, I'm curious what you think specifically we have done, if we've squandered those chances to bring the two nations closer together. Are there things that you could pinpoint specifically?
I can. They're both specific and general. And again, let me emphasize to you and our listeners that my view is very much a minority view among Americans who study Russia and Russian-American relations. I don't claim to have the last word. My only claim is that I've studied these questions for 40 years as an academic, as somebody who writes for the mass media, and this is my best opinion, that the United States at the end of the Cold War, when we said it was over, 1991, 1992, took what I call a triumphalist attitude. We won the Cold War. And therefore, our policymakers began to think of post-communist Russia much in the way that the United States thought about Germany and Japan after their defeat in World War II, which meant that Russia's new role was to be a supplicant, a junior partner of the United States, and take our advice on both its domestic and foreign policy. That was both a complete misreading of how the Cold War ended, if it did end, in 1991, and the nature of Russia. It was so fundamentally wrong that it was impossible. And yet that informed American policy, has informed it ever since. And I will give you an example, a couple examples. Even though we had promised Russia in 1990-91, when Germany was reunited, that we would not expand NATO, the quintessential Cold War military alliance, eastward toward Russia, Clinton began the expansion of NATO toward Russia. President Bush, the second President Bush, continued it. And NATO is now on Russia's borders. That, of course, was the most fundamental act of American triumphalism. But there's something almost equally important. We, the United States, has taken the view toward Russia of what Washington calls selective cooperation. This is an expression that Obama uses, that Mrs. Clinton used when she was Secretary of State. And it means that we will negotiate with Russia on what is in our national interest and ask Russia to give us concessions in that regard. But we don't give reciprocal concessions to Russia in terms of its own national interest. And therefore, the Russian political elite, and it's not a handsome, pretty, virtuous political elite, but it is an elite that thinks and has policy positions and that, for example, Putin must take into account, has formed the view that the United States does not care at all about Russia's national interests. And indeed, Washington has the view that Russia does not have any legitimate national interest, at least none comparable to America's. That is a non-starter. I mean, it's like going into, I don't know, you know, any business partnership and telling your partner, okay, you know, I will make all the decisions based on my interest, and I hope they work out for you. It's a non-starter, and it's been a non-starter. I'll give you the most recent, not the most recent, but the one that every one of your listeners will remember. When we were attacked on 9/11, Putin did more for the United States to help the American ground war in Afghanistan to drive the Taliban out of Kabul. That was before the current war. Than any other country, including NATO. The details aren't important, but he saved American lives. Putin thought that he would get in return an end of NATO expansion toward Russia and a real partnership, an equal partnership with the United States. He did not get that. Instead, President Bush continued the expansion of NATO toward Russia, and he withdrew the United States from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which Russia regarded as the bedrock of its nuclear security. Since that moment, around, let's say, 2002 through 2003, the Russian political elite has not trusted the United States to keep its promises to Russia. And therefore, every little thing is magnified and viewed through that prism of mistrust. And I have to say, though I voted for President Obama twice, that he has done nothing in regard to Russia to diminish that perception of us in Moscow. And that's where we stand today.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Cohn, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies at New York University. There's a lot of threads that I could pick up on. One is it isn't then personality-based. You mentioned you voted twice for President Obama, but you're tracing this history back through political parties. It's not whether Putin and Obama or Putin and Bush or Putin and Clinton get along.
Yeah, I should have said it's entirely bipartisan in the United States. The I mean, the Republican Party has changed in my lifetime in this regard. For example, from being a party that led and favored nuclear arms control agreements with Russia to becoming a party, at least in the Senate today, in opposition to that. But given that change in the Republican Party, the folly, and I think it's folly because I think we need a partnership with Russia for our own national security, is completely bipartisan. And we see that today, for example, in what's being said. What, for example, Senator Schumer, the Democratic senator from my own state of New York, says is no different from what John McCain, the Republican of Arizona, or I think his name is Lindsey Graham,
right,
I think from South Carolina, is saying. This is fully bipartisan. And I have to say that the most astonishing thing for me, since I remember when the Senate was a scene of opposition and discussion and policymaking in regard to Vietnam and other major foreign policy issues, that the Congress has become fully complicit in whatever policy the White House makes toward Russia.
Why is at least a decent working partnership between our two countries important for U.S. national security?
I take a kind of, and again, I don't think this is a widely held view, but there are people in the country who agree with what I'm about to say, that the road to American national security runs through Moscow, as it did during the Cold War. But when the Soviet Union ended, people thought, oh, Russia doesn't matter. People wrote articles with titles such as A World Without Russia or Making Policy Without Russia. And this was myopia. This was ideological delusion. Russia remains, to give you some of the examples, still, however diminished in population, the largest territorial country in the world. But more importantly, it sits right at the fault line, right between Western civilization and Islamic civilization. And we now know that the struggle, whether it's necessary or not, I don't know, between Islamic forces and anti-Islamic forces in the West may be now the front line of our national security. Still more, Russia is itself an Islamic country. The Russian Federation of about 145 million people has about 20 million people of Islamic ethnicity. So we begin there. Secondly, Russia has more natural resources, collectively, in total, than any other country in the world. In that connection, it is still the largest exporter, it varies from some years, of natural gas and oil. Then Russia, of course, is the only other country in the world with a nuclear arsenal comparable to our own. And in addition to that, there are other things. Russia has gotten back on its feet under Putin in international affairs to the extent that it has a lot of influence in the world, diplomatic. For example, we know there will be no resolution in Syria or in the Middle East generally, in Iran, for example, without Russia's cooperation. Or to take an immediate issue, Obama wants to withdraw from Afghanistan. But most of our supplying of NATO and American forces in Afghanistan today is through Russia with the cooperation of Putin. Mm. Therefore, the road out of Afghanistan is also through Russia.
Right.
So it's hard to imagine an area, whether you want to talk about climate, you want to talk about international drug trafficking. The opium flow across Russia from Afghanistan is enormous into Western Europe and onto the United States. It's hard to imagine, if you make a list, Marcy, you and I, of, let's say, the 10 most important national security issues for the United States, where that one could be resolved to our satisfaction without Russia's cooperation, and that any leadership in the United States that doesn't recognize that and make policy accordingly is not a fit national security leadership. And I regard that as a bipartisan indictment of almost every president, and here we can argue a little. Reagan rose to the occasion. The first president, Bush, nearly rose to the occasion. And since then, it's been downhill.
So a last question. What are the wider implications if President Obama does cancel his meeting with President Putin?
Well, it'll be like a bad cold. Both sides will get over it. But remember where we were before Snowden, Edward Snowden, the leaker, our leaker, landed in Moscow. Remember also, Putin didn't invite him, and Obama didn't send him. Both leaders ended up with this guy unwillingly and unwittingly. But before that happened, remember what the direction was in the relationship. The Boston bombings had brought home to the United States that domestic terrorism in the United States wasn't over, and that it had origins in areas, the North Caucasus, where Russia could help us a lot. And therefore, we began a more expansive counterterrorism cooperation with Russia. Second came Syria, the most dangerous crisis in the Middle East in a long time. It could get extremely bad for everyone, including Russia. So the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, the American Secretary of State, John Kerry, with the backings of Putin and Obama, proposed a joint American-Russian effort to do something about that Syrian crisis in the form of a conference. All that was, the possibilities were diminished with the Snowden affair. Mm-hmm. So now Obama's faced with a decision. Are those issues of national security more important than Snowden in a hotel or an apartment somewhere in Moscow? And here's, I think, what it comes down to, that maybe this is not entirely fair to President Obama. But Obama wanted to go to Moscow to see Putin. He's going to go anyway, but he would see him a few days later in a big group at the G20. But the idea was the two of them would sit down and see if they could get on the same page. The opposition to Obama going to Moscow in Washington is enormous, and it's coming from his own party as well. Yet I think Obama knows that it's in America's national security for him to make this trip. So he has to make a decision. It's an issue of leadership now, where his priorities are, where he thinks his leadership and legacy need to go. It's a hard decision for him. If I were advising him, I would tell him to go. But I think he may not.
It's fascinating. We'll watch and see. Professor Cohen, thank you for explaining some of these things for us in a clear, concise way. I appreciate
it. Reminding you that it's my opinion. There are a lot of people who would say I'm entirely wrong.
And we'll try to find them, and everyone can weigh what they think might be the right answer as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Dr. Stephen Cohen is Professor Emeritus of Russian History and Politics at New York University and Princeton University. He's the author of Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, From Stalinism to the New Cold War. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Should you keep renting or buy a house? If you own your home, is this a good time to refinance your mortgage? Get expert answers to your real estate and housing questions in a minute, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evening MBA and ISM program at Seattle Pacific University, hosting an open house on Tuesday, August 6th from 4:30 until 6 p.m. More information and registration is available at spu.edu/business. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
Robert Pinsky has read his poetry with jazz musicians,
blowing his American breath,
and on The Simpsons.
Robert Pinsky's reading at Cafe Kafka.
Robert Pinsky, the former poet laureate?
As I always like to put it, Lisa knows my work.
Robert Pinsky's new book on reading and writing poetry on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m. Weather-wise in Seattle, it's sunny, 71 degrees, expecting sun all day with a high of 85. Overnight, it'll be clear with a low of 59, and then sunny again tomorrow, Tuesday, with a high of 86. It's 9:36. I'm Bernard Ouellette. U.S. embassies across the Middle East and Africa will be closed through Saturday in response to what some lawmakers are saying is the most serious threat of an al-Qaeda attack since 9/11. We'll have an update on that in the news at 10.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Our Puget Sound housing market is on the upswing. In one sense, that's a good thing. It indicates the region's economic health is also on the rise. But if you're thinking of buying a house, rising prices are not so great. So the big question is it time to jump back into the housing market? Maybe you want to buy a condo. Maybe you want to rent an apartment, although that market's heating up as well. What should you do? Joining us now with some answers, real estate agent and appraiser Richard Hager and Linda Taylor, who's the housing director at the Urban League. They join us from time to time to answer your questions. And our phone number is 206-543-5869-543-KUOW, 1-800-289-5869. Well, let's talk about hot housing markets. Am I wrong to characterize Seattle area market that way?
No, not at all.
And part of this to consider is it's almost a tale of two housing markets. If you are in the Magnolia Queen Anne center core of Seattle, incredibly hot housing market, 4% vacancy factor. If you were to go out beyond Marysville and north, it's a little bit slower. So if you hit the 45-mile mark, north or south, it's a slower market. But if you're in King County or at the center core, it's about a one-month housing supply right now.
Is it that much?
Well, yeah.
The last couple of people that purchased out of our home buyer education class purchased in Gold Bar.
Because that's
Gold
as close
bar.
As it, yeah, close as you can get for the price range you want.
That what I had heard recently was that there wasn't recently being June that there really wasn't a lot on the market, and what there was sort of being snapped up in a ways like that hot housing market
that happened
before 2008, yes. Where you know multiple offers were on the table, and is that lessened somewhat or is it still?
I don't think so.
It's still shark circling
looks back. It looks back to be that way. My understanding is people are having inspections done prior to doing a placing an offer.
Yeah, I had heard that as well.
Unheard of.
So does that make it a seller's market?
Oh, absolutely. And it also depends upon the housing price. You know, if you're at $10 million, it's a little slow. But
okay.
if you are anywhere between the modest priced houses, which around here is like $600,000 or less, it is a phenomenally fast-paced market. Multiple offers. We even in our appraisal at American Home Appraisals when we're doing this, there's this they're writing up 20-day closes, 30-day closes, anything to convince the seller to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they call us with an appraisal request, and it's like, can you do it by Tuesday?
Nope.
It's like, get in line, Sparky.
Before the big crash in all the markets, before the recession happened, I know it seemed at least that there were a lot of ways for people to qualify for mortgages. Has it become more difficult for—
A bit. Yeah. Credit is a bit tighter.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So,
before, you could have a pulse and a bank would find a loan for you. Yeah, maybe. Not even that. But today they do put you through the ringer a lot more.
They're reading the rules, I think.
Yeah, they're following the rules. What a novelty. And then a lot of the loan programs that were available before, no income qualifies and things like that, they're not around. So it's back to the way it was prior to about 2000, normal rules, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And just a last question before I go to the phones, and that number again is 206-543-5869. There was a point in time where everybody was looking for a house and the condo market kind of stalled out. Do we have a supply of condos if maybe you don't have the money or the interest in buying a three-bedroom house?
I think there is, but condo fees are so high. So you have to take that into consideration also when you're qualifying. And a lot of the condos that are out there are older.
So
the fees are higher.
What you see is, people love, for the most part, they love to have a standalone house, a backyard, you know, the perfect little idyllic thing. But you're seeing a younger generation that comes up that really does want, like South Lake Union. So they are buying
nice
those condos.
Spot.
They're picking them up. They're more urbanized, small.
Right.
And then you're seeing these suites where they're going in and renting them, and they're nothing more than a hotel room, and they're being snapped up like crazy.
Yeah, I heard last that the vacancy rate for apartments was below 5% in King County.
Oh, that's probably true.
Right.
Questions from listeners. It's your turn. You can email us weekday@kuow.org. In our studios with us, housing purchase experts. Richard Hager is a real estate agent and appraiser, and Linda Taylor is housing director at the Urban League. And perhaps you are just thinking, after sitting out the market, that you want to jump in as a first-time buyer. I know that Linda works with people like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Alicia on Bainbridge Island, you are first. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. We have a home on Bainbridge Island, and our mortgage is $3,200 per month, and it would be a jumbo if we tried to refi, so we can't do that. We're temporarily relocating and trying to figure out whether we should rent. We can't really get more than about $2,600 a month for the rent, or just sell it. You know, in other words, we may want to come back in about 3 years. Should we take that monthly loss? Because we may want to come back, or, you know, do you have any clue as to what the market's doing in the next 2-3 years?
Have you checked with your bank to see if you qualify for that?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a jumbo loan, so no, we don't. We have a great fixed rate right now, so that nobody. We've checked with so many banks; they can't help us improve our monthly payment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can. I can tell you. Let me. Karnak says housing prices will be higher 3 years from today, 2 years from today, more than likely next year. They will be higher. When you say you're going to take a loss, and I understand the cash loss on a per-month basis, absolutely.
Right.
But there's something else for you to consider is you also get a tax write-off on here.
We do?
And yes.
But you need to check with your tax accountant first. I would check with them.
So what happens is when you turn this into a rental property, you have a tax deduction. And you may find that the tax deduction gives you back at the end of the year with your taxes maybe $300-$400 a month, thus neutralizing your overall.
Wonderful.
I want Linda to follow up. What specific questions?
I just like people to check with their tax accountant all the time. I just do not give tax advice. And Richard's right. I mean, that's what's going to happen. But, you know, go seek that out for yourself to see if that's what works for you and your family and your finances.
So before counting on it, thanks for your call, Alicia. We're talking about housing, buying, renting, selling, waiting. Is this the time that people should jump into the market?
Mm-hmm. Both feet.
Right.
Burn the dock. Jump.
Okay. Because people that were foreclosed on a while back, they're now first-time homebuyers again.
Strange
whether they know it or not.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
You start off at zero or?
Right. About 3 years. You could probably buy FHA in 3 to 4 years after a foreclosure if you stayed right.
Hmm.
First-time homebuyer is defined as a person that hasn't owned a home in the last 3 years, and there's a provision for a displaced homemaker. And is that the only two provisions? I think
pretty
those
much.
Are the only two.
Lucas emails in on that same subject. With the market being what it is, do first-time buyers face a disadvantage if they go with FHA?
Not necessarily.
Well, he's kind of talking about from the seller standpoint. Do they want to wait for that FHA appraisal and their list of requirements and things like that?
Well, it depends on if you're a seller, he's a seller?
No, but if the seller has a lot of choices, they're going to choose
right.
somebody
oh,
who has a faster
they
turnaround.
Could.
Absolutely.
They could.
Absolutely. You got 10 people.
Unless they really like you.
Or your agent. So you got 10 people lined up, and the ones that are the most cash laden, if you will, I'm going to put 50% down. They're stand first in line. I'm going to put 10% conventional. They're ahead of the 3.5% FHA VA. More than likely they are. But there's a lot of HUD, FHA, VA applicants that are out there. So part of that is go get qualified first.
And even before that, go to a home ownership class.
Yes.
Go get educated first. And in that education, you will help yourself become the most qualified buyer that's out there.
We're talking about housing and the all of a sudden hot housing market after several years at this point of lull. Linda Taylor is housing director at the Urban League. Also with us is real estate agent and appraiser Richard Hager. Our number is 1-800-289-5869. And Rachel on Vashon Island, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. My question is, I'm a first-time home buyer without any foreclosure history. I really truly have never owned property or a home. And I'm renting a home right now that I have the option to, the mortgage on the home is a federally backed assumable mortgage.
Mm.
And you know, there's some aspects about the property and the home that aren't ideal. It's an older manufactured home, for example, but I cannot compete with buyers that can put earnest money down and pay for an inspection before ever seeing the house. You know, I cannot compete in the blazing hot market. And so my instincts say that assuming this federally backed assumable mortgage is maybe the better way into the market for me than trying to compete with another kind of purchase.
Well, it can be, but part of it is what's the interest rate on it? What's the terms? I'm
right.
Assuming
you
about 25 years.
You assume it at what it is. You
Pardon?
Assume the rate. My understanding is when you have those, you assume the current rate. So
mm-hmm.
You need to know a lot about it.
Yeah, I understand that it's a pretty low rate. The owner refinanced right before the housing bubble.
Okay.
Well, if they refinanced, are you sure it's an assumable loan?
My understanding is that it is, but you're right. I need to
gather knowledge, mm-hmm. gather information
yeah.
on it, set it out
research.
On the deck, and try to see. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something else that's going on is the number of houses that are purchased start to slow down as we hit August 1st. Yay, we're here. And then it gets slower and slower throughout the rest of the year, the low point being Christmas for obvious reasons. So what you may find is more houses available, more choices available for you as we hit December, January, and February. In fact, a good time for you to maybe out looking for a house is around December during the Christmas season when others aren't there. You may find a little bit more housing stock out there. And if all else fails, really jump into it in the January, February. But I wouldn't wait past that.
And I'd always go to a neighborhood that I hadn't considered.
Mm-hmm. But you're on the island, so I assume you're going to stay there. You've got a lot of new construction that's coming up on the west side of Bainbridge Island. There's a lot of old subdivisions that were abandoned that have been recently purchased. They will be building a lot of new homes. Now, it doesn't mean that it fits your budget and what's going on, but the fact that there's homes being built helps absorb mm-hmm. Some of the other people. They can go buy that instead of stealing from you. They've got another choice, if you will.
I wouldn't be surprised if there are some low-income housing developers over there. I just wouldn't be surprised. I'd really do my homework.
Good luck with that quest, Rachel. Yeah, get an agent. So essentially, in order of things, if Rachel has taken a home buying class, and it sounds like maybe not yet, you do that, you get pre-qualified so that you know exactly how much
pre-approved.
Yes.
And that gives you a sense of what your upper limit is, mm-hmm. what your monthly payments would be, and that helps an agent and yourself
absolutely
focus the search
mm-hmm.
for,
yes.
I mean, maybe it's a townhouse, maybe it's not a – do you consider townhomes – condos, or are they standalone homes? Where do they fit?
Well, they usually have condominium associations around them. Not all of them, but
it just depends because you're dealing with a zoning issue mm-hmm. more than others. City of Seattle has a special zoning called townhouses, and effectively it's attached housing. Once you have that attached housing, you can sell them off as single family homes
right.
attached, but they can also be condominium associations.
So you need to look into that. If you don't want to pay the fees, you may be able to find one of those, which might be a little bit less expensive mm-hmm. than a standalone.
There are amenities that come with the fees now.
So it's not just like extra money.
Fees, right.
Yeah.
You
right.
have to check it out.
If you own your own home, you're going to have water, sewer, garbage, insurance costs that go along with a standalone house. You have a condominium. The condominium association, usually your dues includes water, sewer, garbage, cable, and some insurance. So there's a dues, but it's not really – I didn't see any difference between when I lived in condos versus a house. It's kind of the same thing. It's just where you pay it.
Well, I have some people that do, and they're living in older condos,
mm-hmm.
and they go up in price, mm-hmm. the condo mm-hmm. fees. And I saw a woman actually price herself out. Her condo fee actually was more than her Social Security check.
Sure.
She had paid for the house in cash for the condo.
Wow.
And then her condominium fees were higher. But then those are the kind of people I see.
Okay. So people also have to be really clear
right.
what they have.
Read those minutes.
Yep. Read everything. We're talking housing for the rest of this half hour. And Ron, in Port Orchard, you've been so patient. You are on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering how the Kitsap area is shaping up for, one, the builder's market. I have about a city block and a half in the Sherman Heights area, and also for the resale market in general.
Oh, it's as I kind of said at the top of the show, is the center of the universe is literally Seattle. And as you go farther and farther away, the market is slower. But just as we're talking about, a person can't find the house they want in Bainbridge or Vashon or wherever, so they are forced to go farther and farther out.
Mm-hmm.
To that point, we're starting to see where the Kitsap Peninsula, the Key Peninsulas, all of those outlying areas are getting faster. Their housing supply is dropping down to maybe a three-month supply, which is a reasonably balanced market. And so we're starting to see it. The builders, the big builders, we're looking at properties in Olympia, the other side of Olympia, Black Lake and out there. We're up in Anacortes. They're looking for housing subdivisions there because they can't find it in close.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing that market activity pick up. And it all comes back to wherever you are in the state, anywhere in the United States, is are there jobs? And what's the population doing?
That's the key.
That's
the key. We see a lot of builders back in business.
And I was going to ask.
And I'm happy for that because a lot of them were in foreclosure. So.
Right. One of the things that I know was happening probably a decade or so ago, Linda, was that there was a lot of infill happening, particularly in central Seattle, mm-hmm. home site, some development that was aimed at either first-time or lower-income
uh-huh.
buyers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that totally stalled out now?
No, not so much. Homesite has kind of changed their model also. I'm not sure enough about it to quote it, but they've changed their model for the better.
Ron, thanks for that. I'm going to try to get as many of these callers in as we can in the next few minutes. Imamo's in Tukwila. Thank you. You are on the air.
Hello, everyone. So I just wanted to inject a quick comment about my wife and I, our experience. I'm a veteran. We bought a home in Covington, closed on it about 4 weeks ago. And we originally had gotten a pre-approval from a bank. You know, we went in, we found the home we wanted. They pre-approved us with their mortgage company, the builder did, on the spot, offered us cash incentives, everything like that. And after the home was built, we closed quickly, ended up getting money back. It was originally at 309 was what they were asking. We ended up getting financed for 325 at 3.25% interest, zero down. I mean, our experience was just, you know, phenomenal.
That's great.
They're both. They both had big, wide eyes, Imamu, as you were saying this. This is not common, is it?
You just never know. You just never know. Everyone's experience is different, and that builder had good financing, good people working on the ground, and you wanted it.
So it's successful from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. The other side, the builder wasn't supposed to offer cash back to the buyer.
Oh, okay. Well, Imamu, I'm glad you made out well.
Ixnay telnay, we're good.
Good. Congratulations on that. Dolores is in Seattle's International District. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I have a quick question. I'm an older adult. I've owned two houses previously, not in this area, and did very well on that. A couple years ago now, I lost my job. I now have another one. But anyway, I did lose my job, and I declared bankruptcy. I am aware of a condo coming available in the next couple of years because it's a friend of mine in Everett, which would be around, it's appraised now at about $80,000-$90,000, but I would say as much as $100,000. What would be my obstacles to getting back in the housing market after a bankruptcy in 2010?
Has your bankruptcy been discharged?
Yes, it was discharged. And I'm doing great now.
Oh, that's good. You probably don't have many obstacles as long as you're doing great now.
And once you go about 3 years past the bankruptcy,
two, three years. Just depends on who finances it.
It becomes a smaller and smaller problem as the mm-hmm. years go by. So don't let that slow you down.
No,
if
I
you
wouldn't.
Can figure out, you know, go talk to the bank and, you know, lay your cards out on the table and say, I want to buy something.
This is it. Local banks usually help a little bit.
Right.
Credit
right.
unions help pretty well.
And the sooner you get in, the better, because the interest rates are so low. I don't, you know, 2 years from today, I don't expect them to be at the same mm-hmm. rate here, and housing prices will be higher.
Are you renting it now or leasing the?
I'm not renting it now. I am renting, but no, I'm in mm-hmm. Seattle now, but it's an effort, and I just feel one of the things I learned through bankruptcy is living within my means, and something that is $80,000 or $90,000 would definitely be within my means. Of course, the trade-off is I would be farther away from the city, but
transportation is getting better in our area. Slow, but it's getting better.
Yeah, you can look forward to some light rail heading up to Everett. Good luck with that, Dolores. And just a last email from Moses: is the increase in people buying property with houses for the purpose of renting them out increasing the cost of home ownership? And if so, should people consider paying more to own rather than renting?
Well, you've got a couple of things going on. First of all, you've got our population increasing.
Right.
In the state of Washington, roughly 100,000 people a year. It fluctuates anywhere between 60 to 100,000 people a year. They're coming. They're buying houses. They need rental places. And so waiting is not a good idea because they keep coming.
They keep coming.
We're not building apartments. Arguably, they're building apartments at a rate that could handle. But the new apartments that are being built are incredibly high rent, you know, way beyond the means of most people. So I could say that they're not building them in the right price range, or they can't because of land mm-hmm. use regulations and the like.
Parking.
Absolutely. Now, do people buying rentals and turning around, does that increase prices? Absolutely. But again, you buy it, it still is a living unit, whether you've right. own it in there or you've purchased it for somebody else to live there as a rental.
There are a lot of investment groups buying a lot
sure.
of waiting for short sales, where a lot of people don't have the patience for short sales. They do.
Mm-hmm. And we have to leave this conversation right there. It looks like a lot of people are ready to jump back into the market. So we'll address this topic again in the near future. We'd like to thank real estate agent and appraiser Richard Hager and Linda Taylor, housing director at the Urban League. Thanks for coming in again.
You're welcome.
And now, the sound of the day. Very nice. That's the sound of Maura's day, the sound of her ballet class. Maura's been an adult student of Vera Altunina at the International Ballet Academy in Kirkland for the past 9 years. Vera teaches the Vaganova method. Her class is rigorous but extracts beauty from technical work, according to Maura. Well, whether you're dancing or farming or petting a cat, what are you listening to? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you hear and send the sound to us. Along with the story behind the sound, email the file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include Sound of the Day in the subject line. Coming up in the next hour, the sound of pages turning. Nancy Pearl joins us and we talk about some books that will send you traveling without you even having to move out of your armchair. Coming up on Weekday.
It's 9:59. Later today, the words you love and the words you hate. Well, let's say words or phrases. Do you love the word mellifluous? Do you hate it when people say, whatever, or it is what it is? Share with us your rants and raves. Call our feedback line, 206-221-3663. What words or phrases do you hate or love, and why? 206-221-3663. Then join us for that this afternoon at 12:40.
Words in papers, words in books, words on TV, words for books.
KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.